Interzone. The only native in Interzone who is neither queer nor available is Andrew Keefe's chauffeur, which is not affectation or perversity on Keefe's part, but a useful pretext to break off relations with anyone he doesn't want to see. "You made a pass at Arachnid last night. Can't have you in the house again." People are always blacking out in the zone, whether they drink or not, and no one can say for sure he didn't make a pass at Arachnid's unappetizing person. Arachnid is a worthless chauffeur, barely able to drive. On one occasion he ran down a pregnant woman in from the mountains with a load of charcoal on her back, and she miscarried a bloody dead baby in the street, and Keefe got out and sat on the curb stirring the blood with a stick while the police questioned Arachnid and finally arrested the woman for a violation of the sanitary code. Arachnid is a grimly unattractive young man with a long face of strange slate-blue color. He has a big nose and great yellow teeth like a horse. Anybody can find an attractive chauffeur, but only Andrew Keefe could have found Arachnid. Keefe, the brilliant, decadent young novelist who lives in a remodeled pissoir in the red-light district of the native quarter. The zone is a single, vast building. The rooms are made of a plastic cement that bulges to accommodate people, but when too many crowd into one room, there is a soft plop, and someone squeezes through the wall right into the next house. The next bed, that is, since the rooms are mostly bed, where the business of the zone is transacted. A hum of sex and commerce shakes the zone like a vast hive.
2/3 of 1%. I won't budge from that figure, not even from my snookums.
But where are the bills of lading, lover?
Not where you're looking, pet. That's too obvious.
A bale of Levi's with built-in falsy baskets. Made in Hollywood.
Hollywood Siam.
Well, American style.
What's the commission? The commission. The commission.
Yes, Nugget. A shipload of KY made of genuine whale wreck in the South Atlantic, at present quarantined by the Board of Health in Tierra del Fuego. The commission, my dear. If we can pull this off, we'll be in clover.
Whale dreck is reject material that accumulates in the process of cutting up a whale and cooking it down. A horrible, fishy mess you can smell for miles. No one has found any use for it. Interzone Imports Unlimited, which consists of Marvy and Leaf the Unlucky, had latched onto the KY deal. In fact, they specialize in pharmaceuticals and run a 24-hour pro station, 6 ways coverage, 4 and aft, as a sideline. 6 separate venereal diseases have been identified to date. They plunge into the deal. They perform unmentionable services for a spastic Greek shipping agent and one entire shift of customs inspectors. The two partners fall out and finally denounce each other in the embassy, where they are referred to the "We Don't Want to Hear About It" department and eased out a back door into a shit-strewn vacant lot where vultures fight over fish heads. They flail at each other hysterically.
"You're trying to fuck me out of my commission."
"Your commission? Who smelled out this good thing in the first place?"
"But I have that bill of lading."
"Monster! But the check will be made out in my name."
"Bastard! You'll never see the bill of lading until my cut is deposited in escrow."
"Well, might as well kiss and make up. There's nothing mean or petty about me."
They shake hands without enthusiasm and peck each other on the cheek. The deal drags on for months. They engage the services of an expediter. Finally, Marvy emerges with a check for 42 Turkestani kurus drawn on an anonymous bank in South America to clear through Amsterdam, a procedure that will take 11 months, more or less. Now he can relax in the cafes of the plaza. He shows a photostatic copy of the check. He would never show the original, of course, lest some envious citizen spit ink eradicator on the signature or otherwise mutilate the check. Everyone asks him to buy drinks and celebrate, but he laughs jovially and says,
"Fact is, I can't afford to buy myself a drink. I already spent every kuru of it buying penstrep for Ollie's clap. He's down with it fore and aft again. I came near kicking the little bastard right through the wall into the next bed. But you all know what a sentimental old thing I am."
Marvy does buy himself a shot glass of beer, squeezing a blackened coin out of his fly under the table.
"Keep the change."
The waiter sweeps the coin into a dustpan. He spits on the table and walks away.
"Sorehead, he's envious of my check."
Marvy had been in Interzone since
the year before one, as he put it.
He had been retired from some unspecified position in the State Department.
"For the good of the service."
Obviously, he had once been very good-looking in a crew-cut college boy way. But his face had sagged and formed lumps under the chin, like melting paraffin. He was getting heavy around the hips. Leif the Unlucky was a tall, thin Norwegian with a patch over one eye, his face congealed in a permanent, ingratiating smirk. Behind him lay an epic saga of unsuccessful enterprises. He had failed at raising frogs, chinchilla, Siamese fighting fish, rami, and cultured pearls. He had attempted, variously and without success, to promote a lovebird two-in-a-coffin cemetery, to corner the condom market during the rubber shortage, to run a mail-order whorehouse, to issue penicillin as a patent medicine. He had followed disastrous betting systems in the casinos of Europe and the racetracks of the U.S. His reverses in business were matched by the incredible mischances of his personal life. His front teeth had been stomped out by bestial American sailors in Brooklyn. Vultures had eaten out an eye when he drank a pint of paregoric and passed out in a Panama City park. He had been trapped between floors in an elevator for 5 days with an oil-burning junk habit and sustained an attack of DTs while stowing away in a footlocker. Then there was the time he collapsed with strangulated intestines, perforated ulcers, and peritonitis in Cairo, and the hospital was so crowded they bedded him in the latrine, and the Greek surgeon goofed and sewed up a live monkey in him, and he was gang-fucked by the Arab attendants, and one of the orderlies stole the penicillin, substituting Saniflush. And the time he got clap in his ass, and a self-righteous English doctor cured him with an enema of hot sulfuric acid, and the German practitioner of technological medicine who removed his appendix with a rusty can opener and a pair of tin snips. He considered the germ theory
a nonsense.
Flushed with success, he then began snipping and cutting out everything in sight.
"The human body is filled up with unnecessitated parts. You can get by with one kidney. I have two. Yes, that is a kidney. The inside part should not be so close in together, crowded. They need Lebensraum in the Vaterland."
The expediter had not yet been paid, and Marvy was faced by the prospect of stalling him for 11 months until the check cleared. The expediter was said to have been born on the ferry between the zone and the island. His profession was to expedite the delivery of merchandise. No one knew for sure whether his services were of any use or not, and to mention his name always precipitated an argument. Cases were cited to prove his miraculous efficiency and utter worthlessness. The island was a British military and naval station directly opposite the zone. England holds the island on yearly rent-free lease, and every year the lease and permit of residence is formally renewed. The entire population turns out, attendance is compulsory, and gathers at the municipal dump. The president of the island is required by custom to crawl across the garbage on his stomach and deliver the permit of residence and renewal of the lease, signed by every citizen of the island, to the resident governor, who stands resplendent in dress uniform. The governor takes the permit and shoves it into his coat pocket.
"Well," he says with a tight smile, "so you've decided to let us stay another year, have you? Very good of you, and everyone is happy about it. Is there anyone who isn't happy about it?"
Soldiers in jeeps sweep mounted machine guns back and forth across the crowd with a slow, searching movement.
Everybody happy? Well, that's fine.
He turns jovially to the prostrate president.
I'll keep your papers in case I get caught short. Ho, ho, ho!
His loud, metallic laugh rings out across the dump, and the crowd laughs with him under the searching guns. The forms of democracy are scrupulously enforced on the island. There is a Senate and a Congress who carry on endless sessions discussing garbage disposal and outhouse inspection, the only two questions over which they have jurisdiction. For a brief period in the mid-19th century, they had been allowed to control the Department of Baboon Maintenance, but this privilege had been withdrawn owing to absenteeism in the Senate. The purple-assed Tripoli baboons had been brought to the island by pirates in the 17th century. There was a legend that when the baboons left the island, it would fall. To whom, or in what way, is not specified, and it is a capital offense to kill a baboon, though the noxious behavior of these animals harries the citizens almost beyond endurance. Occasionally someone goes berserk, kills several baboons and himself. The post of president is always forced on some particularly noxious and unpopular citizen. To be elected president is the greatest misfortune and disgrace that can befall an islander. The humiliations and ignominy are such that few presidents live out their full term of office, usually dying of a broken spirit after a year or two. The expediter had once been president and served the full 5 years of his term. Subsequently, he changed his name and underwent plastic surgery to blot out, as far as possible, the memory of his disgrace.
"Yes, of course. We'll pay you,"
Marvie was saying to the expediter.
"But take it easy. It may be a little while yet."
"Take it easy? A little while?"
"Listen."
"Yes, I know it all. The finance company is repossessing your wife's artificial kidney. They are evicting your grandmother from her iron lung."
"That's in rather bad taste, old boy."
"Frankly, I wish I had never involved myself in this, matter. That bloody grease has too much carbolic in it. I was down to customs one day last week. Stuck a broom handle into a drum of it, and the grease ate the end off straight away. Besides, the stink is enough to knock a man on his bloody ass. You should take a walk down by the port."
"I do no such thing," Marvie screeched.
It is a mark of caste in the zone, never to touch or even go near what you are selling. To do so gives rise to suspicion of retailing, that is, of being a common peddler. A good part of the merchandise in the zone is sold through street peddlers.
"Why do you tell me all this? It's too sordid. Let the retailers worry about it."
"Oh, it's all very well for you chaps. You can scud out from under, but I have a reputation to maintain. There'll be a spot of bother about this."
"Do you suggest there is something illegitimate in this operation?"
"Not illegitimate, exactly, but shoddy, definitely shoddy."
"Oh, go back to your island before it falls. We knew you when you were peddling your purple ass in the Plaza Pissoirs for 5 pesetas.
"And not many takers, either,"
Leaf put in. He pronounced it "either." This reference to his island origin was more than the expediter could stand. He was drawing himself up, mobilizing his most frigid impersonation of an English aristocrat, preparing to deliver an icy, clipped crusher. But instead, a whining, whimpering, kicked dog snarl broke from his mouth. His pre-surgery face emerged in an arc light of incandescent hate. He began to spit curses in the hideous, strangled gutturals of the island dialect. The islanders all profess ignorance of the dialect, or flatly deny its existence.
"We are British," they say. "We don't got no bloody dialect."
Froth gathered at the corners of the expediter's mouth. He was spitting little balls of saliva like pieces of cotton. The stench of spiritual vileness hung in the air about him like a green cloud. Marvie and Leaf fell back, twittering in alarm.
"He's gone mad,"
Marvy gasped.
Let's get out of here.
Hand in hand, they skip away into the mist that covers the zone in the winter months like a cold Turkish bath. The Examination. Carl Peterson found a postcard in his box requesting him to report for a 10 o'clock appointment with Dr. Benway in the Ministry of Mental Hygiene and Prophylaxis. What on earth could they want with me? He thought irritably. A mistake, most likely. But he knew they didn't make mistakes, certainly not mistakes of identity. It would not have occurred to Carl to disregard the appointment, even though failure to appear entailed no penalty. Freeland was a welfare state. If a citizen wanted anything from a load of bone meal to a sexual partner, some department was ready to offer effective aid. The threat implicit in this enveloping benevolence stifled the concept of rebellion. Carl walked through the town hall square. Nickel nudes 60 feet high with brass genitals soaped themselves under gleaming showers. The town hall cupola of glass, brick, and copper crashed into the sky. Carl stared back at a homosexual American tourist who dropped his eyes and fumbled with the light filters of his Leica. Carl entered the steel enamel labyrinth of the ministry, strode to the information desk, and presented his card.
Fifth floor, room 26.
In room 26, a nurse looked at him with cold, undersea eyes. Dr. Benway is expecting you, she said, smiling. Go right in. As if he had nothing to do but wait for me, thought Carl. The office was completely silent and filled with milky light. The doctor shook Carl's hand, keeping his eyes on the young man's chest. I've seen this man before, Carl thought, but where? He sat down and crossed his legs. He glanced at an ashtray on the desk and lit a cigarette. He turned to the doctor a steady, inquiring gaze, in which there was more than a touch of insolence. The doctor seemed embarrassed. He fidgeted and coughed and fumbled with papers.
He said, finally. Your name is Carl Peterson, I believe.
His glasses slid down onto his nose in parody of the academic manner. Carl nodded silently. The doctor did not look at him, but seemed nonetheless to register the acknowledgement. He pushed his glasses back into place with one finger and opened a file on the white enameled desk.
Carl Peterson.
He repeated the name caressingly, pursed his lips, and nodded several times. He spoke again abruptly.
You know, of course, that we are trying. We are all trying. Sometimes, of course, we don't succeed.
His voice trailed off, thin and tenuous. He put a hand to his forehead.
To adjust the state, simply a tool, to the needs of each individual citizen.
His voice boomed out so unexpectedly deep and loud that Carl started.
That is the only function of the state as we see it. Our knowledge, incomplete, of course.
He made a slight gesture of deprecation.
For example, take the matter of, sexual deviation.
The doctor rocked back and forth in his chair. His glasses slid down onto his nose. Carl felt suddenly uncomfortable.
We regard it as a misfortune, a sickness. Certainly nothing to be censured or, sanctioned any more than, say, tuberculosis, yes.
He repeated firmly, as if Carl had raised an objection.
Tuberculosis. On the other hand, you can readily see that any illness imposes certain, should we say, obligation, certain necessities of a prophylactic nature on the authorities concerned with public health, such necessities to be imposed, needless to say, with a minimum of inconvenience and hardship to the unfortunate individual who has, through no fault of his own, become, infected. That is to say, of course, the minimum hardship compatible with adequate protection of other individuals who are not so infected. We do not find obligatory vaccination for smallpox an unreasonable measure, nor isolation for certain contagious diseases. I am sure you will agree that individuals infected with what the French call les maladies galantes should be compelled to undergo treatment if they do not report voluntarily.
The doctor went on chuckling and rocking in his chair like a mechanical toy. Carl realized that he was expected to say something. "That seems reasonable," he said. The doctor stopped chuckling. He was suddenly motionless.
"Now, to get back to this matter of sexual deviation. Frankly, we don't pretend to understand, at least not completely, why some men and women prefer the sexual company of their own sex. We do know that the phenomenon is common enough and, under certain circumstances, a matter of concern to this department."
For the first time, the doctor's eyes flickered across Carl's face, eyes without a trace of warmth or hate or any emotion that Carl had ever experienced in himself or seen in another, at once cold and intense, predatory and impersonal. Carl suddenly felt trapped in this silent underwater cave of a room, cut off from all sources of warmth and certainty, his picture of himself sitting there, calm, alert, with a trace of well-mannered contempt, went dim, as if vitality were draining out of him to mix with the milky gray medium of the room.
"Treatment of these disorders is, at the present time, symptomatic."
The doctor suddenly threw himself back in his chair and burst into peals of metallic laughter. Carl watched him, appalled. "The man is insane," he thought. The doctor's face went blank as a gambler's. Carl felt an odd sensation in his stomach, like the sudden stopping of an elevator. The doctor was studying the file in front of him. He spoke in a tone of slightly condescending amusement.
"Don't look so frightened, young man. Just a professional joke. To say treatment is symptomatic means there is none, except to make the patient feel as comfortable as possible. And that is precisely what we attempt to do in these cases."
Once again, Carl felt the impact of that cold interest on his face.
"That is to say, reassurance when reassurance is necessary, and, of course, suitable outlets with other individuals of similar tendencies. No isolation is indicated. The condition is no more directly contagious than cancer." "Cancer, my first love."
The doctor's voice receded. He seemed actually to have gone away through an invisible door, leaving his empty body sitting there at the desk. Suddenly he spoke again in a crisp voice.
"And so you may well wonder why we concern ourselves with the matter at all."
He flashed a smile, bright and cold as snow in sunlight. Carl shrugged. "That is not my business. What I am wondering is why you have asked me to come here and why you tell me all this...
"Nonsense."
Carl was annoyed to find himself blushing. The doctor leaned back and placed the ends of his fingers together.
"The young," he said indulgently. "Always they are in a hurry. One day, perhaps, you will learn the meaning of patience. No, Carl, I may call you Carl. I am not evading your question. In cases of suspected tuberculosis, we... that is, the appropriate department may ask, even request, someone to appear for a fluoroscopic examination. This is routine, you understand. Most of such examinations turn up negative. So, you have been asked to report here for, should I say, a psychic fluoroscope? I may add that, after talking with you, I feel relatively sure that the result will be, for practical purposes, negative.
But the whole thing is ridiculous. I have always interested myself only in girls. I have a steady girl now, and we plan to marry.
Yes, Carl, I know. And that is why you are here. A blood test prior to marriage. This is reasonable, no?
Please, doctor, speak directly. The doctor did not seem to hear. He drifted out of his chair and began walking around behind Carl, his voice languid and intermittent like music down a windy street.
I may tell you in strictest confidence that there is definite evidence of a hereditary factor. Social pressure. Many homosexuals, latent and overt, do, unfortunately, marry. Such marriages often result in... factor of infantile environment.
The doctor's voice went on and on. He was talking about schizophrenia, cancer, hereditary dysfunction of the hypothalamus. Carl dozed off. He was opening a green door. A horrible smell grabbed his lungs, and he woke up with a shock. The doctor's voice was strangely flat and lifeless, a whispering, junky voice.
The Bloomberg-Stanislavski semen flocculation test, a diagnostic tool. Indicative, at least in a negative sense, in certain cases useful, taken as part of the whole picture. Perhaps under the, circumstances...
The doctor's voice shot up to a pathetic scream.
The nurse will take your, specimen...
This way, please.
The nurse opened the door into a bare, white-walled cubicle. She handed him a jar.
Use this, please. Just yell when you're ready.
There was a jar of KY on a glass shelf. Carl felt ashamed, as if his mother had laid out a handkerchief for him. Some coy little message stitched on, like, "If I was a cunt, we could open a dry goods store." Ignoring the KY, he ejaculated into the jar, a cold, brutal fuck of the nurse, standing her up against a glass brick wall. "Old glass cunt," he sneered, and saw a cunt full of colored glass splinters under the northern lights. He washed his penis and buttoned up his pants. Something was watching his every thought and movement with cold, sneering hate, the shifting of his testes, the contractions of his rectum. He was in a room filled with green light. There was a stained wood double bed, a black wardrobe with full-length mirror. Carl could not see his face. Someone was sitting in a black hotel chair. He was wearing a stiff-bosomed white shirt and a dirty paper tie, the face swollen, skull-less, eyes like burning pus.
"Something wrong?"
said the nurse indifferently. She was holding a glass of water out to him. She watched him drink with aloof contempt. She turned and picked up the jar with obvious distaste. The nurse turned to him.
"Are you waiting for something special?"
she snapped. Carl had never been spoken to like that in his adult life. "Why, no.
You can go, then."
She turned back to the jar. With a little exclamation of disgust, she wiped a gob of semen off her hand. Carl crossed the room and stood at the door.
"Do I have another appointment?"
She looked at him in disapproving surprise.
"You'll be notified, of course."
She stood in the doorway of the cubicle and watched him walk through the outer office and open the door. He turned and attempted a jaunty wave. The nurse did not move or change her expression. As he walked down the stairs, the broken, false grin burned his face with shame. A homosexual tourist looked at him and raised a knowing eyebrow.
"Something wrong?"
Carl ran into a park and found an empty bench beside a bronze fawn with symbols.
Let your hair down, chicken. You'll feel better.
The tourist was leaning over him, his camera swinging in Carl's face like a great dangling tit.
Fuck off, you!
Carl saw something ignoble and hideous reflected back in the queen's spayed animal brown eyes.
Oh, I wouldn't be calling any names if I were you, chicken. You're hooked, too. I saw you coming out of the Institute.
What do you mean by that? Carl demanded.
Oh, nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, Carl, the doctor began,
smiling and keeping his eyes on a level with Carl's mouth.
I have some good news for you.
He picked up a slip of blue paper off the desk and went through an elaborate pantomime of focusing his eyes on it.
Your, test, the Robinson-Kleiberg flocculation test.
I thought it was a Blomberg-Stanislavski test. The doctor tittered.
Oh, dear, no. You are getting ahead of me, young man. You might have misunderstood. The Blomberg-Stanislavski, well, that's a different sort of test altogether. I do hope not necessary.
He tittered again.
But as I was saying before, I was so charmingly interrupted by my learned young colleague. Your RK seems to be,
he held the slip at arm's length,
completely negative. So perhaps we won't be troubling you any further. And so,
he folded the slip carefully into a file. He leafed through the file. Finally, he stopped and frowned and pursed his lips. He closed the file and put his hand flat on it and leaned forward.
Carl, when you were doing your military service, there must have been, in fact, there were long periods when you found yourself deprived of the consolations and facilities of the fair sex. During these no doubt trying and difficult periods, you had perhaps a pin-up girl, or more likely a pin-up harem?
Carl looked at the doctor with overt distaste. Yes, of course, he said. We all did.
And now, Carl, I would like to show you some pin-up girls.
He pulled an envelope out of a drawer.
And ask you to please pick out the one you would most like to make.
He suddenly leaned forward, fanning the photographs in front of Carl's face.
Pick a girl. Any girl.
Carl reached out with numb fingers and touched one of the photographs. The doctor put the photo back into the pack and shuffled and cut, and he placed the pack on Carl's file and slapped it smartly. He spread the photos face up in front of Carl.
Is she there?
Carl shook his head.
Of course not. She is in here where she belongs. A woman's place, what?
He opened the file and held out the girl's photo attached to a Rorschach plate.
Is that her?
Carl nodded silently.
You have good taste, my boy. I may tell you in strictest confidence that some of these girls...
With gambler fingers, he shifts the photos in three-card Monte passes.
Are really boys. In, drag, I believe is the word.
His eyebrows shot up and down with incredible speed. Carl could not be sure he had seen anything unusual. The doctor's face opposite him was absolutely immobile and expressionless. Once again, Carl experienced the floating sensation in his stomach and genitals of a sudden elevator stop.
Yes, Carl, you seem to be running our little obstacle course with flying colors. I guess you think this is all pretty silly, don't you now?
Well, to tell the truth, yes.
You are frank, Carl. This is good. And now... Carl,
he dragged the name out caressingly like a sweet con dick about to offer you an old gold, just like a cop to smoke old gold somehow, and go into his act. The con dick does a little dance step.
Why don't you make the man a proposition?
He jerks a head towards his glowering superego, who is always referred to in the third person as the man or the lieutenant.
That's the way the lieutenant is. You play fair with him, and he'll play fair with you. We'd like to go light on you, if you could help us in some way.
His words open out onto a desolate waste of cafeterias and street corners and lunchrooms. Junkies look the other way, munching pound cake.
The fag is wrong.
The fag slumps in a hotel chair, knocked out on goofballs with his tongue lolling out. He gets up in a goofball trance, hangs himself without altering his expression or pulling his tongue in. The dick is diddling on a pad.
No Marty Steele?
Diddle. Yes?
Can you score off him?
Diddle, diddle. He's skeptical.
But you can score, diddle, diddle. You scored off him last week, didn't you? Diddle?
Yes.
Well, you can score off him this week. Diddle, diddle, diddle. You can score off him today.
No diddle. No. No, not that.
Now look, are you going to cooperate?
Three vicious diddles.
Or does the man cornhole you?
He raises a fey eyebrow.
And so, Carl, you will please oblige to tell me how many times and under what circumstances you have indulged in homosexual acts?
His voice drifts away.
If you have never done so, I shall be inclined to think of you as a somewhat atypical young man.
The doctor raises a coy, admonishing finger.
In any case,
he tapped the file and flashed a hideous leer. Carl noticed that the file was 6 inches thick. In fact, it seemed to have thickened enormously since he entered the room. Well, when I was doing my military service, these queers used to proposition me, and sometimes, when I was blank...
Yes, of course, Carl, the doctor brayed heartily. In your position, I would have done the same, I don't mind telling you. Well, I guess we can dismiss as irrelevant these understandable means of replenishing the exchequer. And now, Carl, there were perhaps...
One finger tapped the file, which gave out a faint effluvium of moldy jockstraps and chlorine.
Occasions when no, economic factors were involved.
A green flare exploded in Carl's brain. He saw Hans's lean brown body twisting towards him, quick breath on his shoulder. The flare went out. Some huge insect was squirming in his hand. His whole being jerked away in an electric spasm of revulsion. Carl got to his feet, shaking with rage. What are you writing there? He demanded.
Do you often doze off like that, in the middle of a conversation?
I wasn't asleep. That is...
You weren't?
It's just that the whole thing is unreal. I'm going now. I don't care. You can't force me to stay. He was walking across the room towards the door. He had been walking a long time. A creeping numbness dragged his legs. The door seemed to recede.
Where can you go, Carl?
The doctor's voice reached him from a great distance. Out, away, through the door.
The green door, Carl?
The doctor's voice was barely audible. The whole room was exploding out into space. Have you seen Pantapon Rose?
Have you seen Pantapon Rose? Said the old junkie. Time to cosk.
Put on a black overcoat and made the square. Down Skid Row to Market Street Museum shows all kinds, masturbation and self-abuse. Young boys need it special. The gangster in concrete rolls down the river channel. They cowboyed him in the steam room. Is this cherry-ass Joe the towel boy or Mother Gillig, old auntie of Westminster Place? Only dead fingers talk in braille. The Mississippi rolls great limestone boulders down the silent alley.
"Clutter the glind!"
screamed the captain of moving land. Distant rumble of stomachs. Poisoned pigeons rain from the northern lights. The reservoirs are empty. Brass statues crash through the hungry squares and alleys of the gaping city, probing for a vein in the junk-sick morning. Strictly from cough syrup. 1,000 junkies storm the crystal spine clinics, cook down the gray ladies. In the limestone cave met a man with Medusa's head in a hat box and said, "Be careful," to the customs inspector. Freeze forever hand an inch from the false bottom. Window dressers scream through the station, beat the cashiers with the fairy hype. The hype is a short change con, also known as the bill.
"Multiple fracture," said the big physician. "I'm very technical."
Conspicuous consumption is rampant in the porticoes, slippery with cock spit. The centipede nuzzles the iron door, rusted to thin black paper by the urine of a million fairies. This is no rich mother lode, but vitiate dust. Second-run cottons trace the bones of a fix.
Coke bugs. The sailor's gray felt hat and black overcoat hung twisted in atrophied yen weight. Morning sun outlined the sailor in the orange-yellow flame of junk. He had a paper napkin under his coffee cup, mark of those who do a lot of sitting over coffee in the plazas, restaurants, terminals, and waiting rooms of the world. A junkie, even at the sailor's level, runs on junk time, and when he makes his importunate eruption into the time of others, like all petitioners, he must wait. How many coffees in an hour? A boy came in and sat at the counter in broken lines of long, sick junk weight. The sailor shivered. His face fuzzed out of focus in a shuddering brown mist. His hands moved on the table, reading the boy's braille. His eyes traced little dips and circles, following whorls of brown hair on the boy's neck in a slow, searching movement. The boy stirred and scratched the back of his neck.
"Something bit me, Joe. What kind of creep joint you run here?"
"Coke bugs, kid," Joe said, holding eggs up to the light. "I was traveling with Irene Kelly, and her was a sporting woman. In Butte, state of Montana, her got the coke horrors and run through the hotel screaming Chinese coppers chaser with meat cleavers. I knew this cop in Chai sniffed coke used to come in form of crystals, blue crystals. So her go nuts and start screaming the Federals is after him and run down this alley and stick his head in a garbage can. And I said, 'What do you think you're doing?' And her say, 'Get away or I'll shoot you. I got myself hid good. When the roll is called up yonder, we'll be there, right?'"
Joe looked at the sailor and spread his hands in the junky shrug. The sailor spoke in his feeling voice that reassembles in your head, spelling out the words with cold fingers. "Your connection is broken, kid." The boy shied. His street boy face, torn with black scars of junk, retained a wild, broken innocence. Shy animals peering out through gray arabesques of terror.
"I don't dig you, Jack."
The sailor leapt into sharp, junky focus. He turned back his coat lapel, showing a brass hypo needle covered with mold and verdigris.
"Retired for the good of the service. Sit down, have a blueberry crumb pie on the expense account. Your monkey loves it. Make his coat glossy."
The boy felt a touch on his arm across 8 feet of morning lunchroom. He was suddenly siphoned into the booth, landing with an inaudible schlup. He looked into the sailor's eyes, a green universe stirred by cold black currents.
"You an agent, mister?"
"I prefer the word vector." His sounding laughter vibrated through the boy's substance.
"You holding, man? I got the bread."
"I don't want your money, honey. I want your time."
"I don't dig."
"You want fix? You want straight? You want a nod?" The sailor cradled something pink and vibrated out of focus.
"Yeah."
"We'll take the independent. Got their own special heat. Don't carry guns, only saps. I recall me and the fag fell once in Queens Plaza.
Stay away from Queens Plaza, son. Evil spot. Fuzz haunted. Too many levels. Heat flares out from the broom closet, high on ammonia like burning lions. Fall on poor old Lush worker, scare her veins right down to the bone. Her skin pop a week. Or do that 529 kick handed out free and gratis by NYC to jostling junkies. So fag, beagle, Irish, sailor, beware. Look down along that line before you travel there. The subway sweeps by with a black blast of iron. Queens Plaza is a bad spot for Lush workers. Too many levels and lurking places for subway heat, and impossible to cover when you put the hand out. 5 months and 29 days, sentence given for jostling, that is, touching a flop with obvious intent. Innocent people may be convicted of murder, but not of jostling. Fag, beagle, Irish, sailor, old-time junkies and Lush workers of my acquaintance. The old 103rd Street clatch. Sailor and Irish hang themselves in the tombs. The beagle is dead of an overdose, and the fag went wrong. The exterminator does a good job. The sailor touched the door gently, following patterns of painted oak in a slow twist, leaving faint, iridescent whorls of slime. His arm went through to the elbow. He pulled back an inside bolt and stood aside for the boy to enter. Heavy, colorless smell of death filled the empty room. "The trap hasn't been aired since the exterminator fumigated for coke bugs," said the sailor apologetically. The boy's peeled senses darted about in frenzied exploration. Tenement flat, railroad flat, vibrating with silent motion. Along one wall of the kitchen, a metal trough, or was it metal, exactly, ran into a sort of aquarium or tank half-filled with translucent green fluid. Moldy objects, worn out in unknown service, littered the floor, a jockstrap designed to protect some delicate organ of flat, fan shape. Multi-leveled trusses, supports, and bandages, a large U-shaped yoke of porous pink stone, little lead tubes cut open at one end. Currents of movement from the two bodies stirred stagnant odor pools, atrophied boy smell of dusty locker rooms, swimming pool chlorine, dried semen. Other smells curled through pink convolutions, touching unknown doors. The sailor reached under the washstand and extracted a package in wrapping paper that shredded and fell from his fingers in yellow dust. He laid out dropper, needle, and spoon on a table covered with dirty dishes, but no roach antennae felt for the crumbs of darkness. "The exterminator does a good job," said the sailor. "Almost too good sometimes." He dipped into a square tin of yellow pyrethrum powder and pulled out a flat package covered in red and gold Chinese paper. Like a firecracker package, the boy thought. At 14, lost 2 fingers, 4th of July fireworks accident. Later in the hospital, first silent, proprietary touch of junk. "They go off here, kid." The sailor put a hand to the back of his head. He camped obscenely as he opened the package, a complex arrangement of slots and overlays. "Pure 100% H. Scarcely a man is now alive, and it's all yours."
"So you want what off me?"
"Time."
"I don't dig."
"I have something you want." His hand touched the package. He drifted away into the front room, his voice remote and blurred. "You have something I want. 5 minutes here, an hour someplace else, 2, 4, 8. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Every day, die a little. It takes up the time."
He moved back into the kitchen, his voice loud and clear. 5 years apiece. Nobody gives a better deal on the street. He put a finger on the dividing line below the boy's nose, right down the middle.
"Mister, I don't know what you're talking about."
"You will, baby. In time."
"Okay, so what do I do?"
"You accept?"
"Yeah, like..."
He glanced at the package.
Whatever. I accept.
The boy felt a silent black clunk fall through his flesh. The sailor put a hand to the boy's eyes and pulled out a pink scrotal egg with one closed, pulsing eye. Black fur boiled inside translucent flesh of the egg. The sailor caressed the egg with nakedly inhuman hands, black-pink, thick, fibrous, long white tendrils sprouting from abbreviated fingertips. Death fear and death weakness hit the boy, shutting off his breath, stopping his blood. He leaned against a wall that seemed to give slightly. He clicked back into junk focus. The sailor was cooking a shot.
"When the roll is called up yonder, we'll be there, right?" he said,
feeling along the boy's vein, erasing goose pimples with a gentle old woman finger. He slid the needle in. A red orchid bloomed at the bottom of the dropper. The sailor pressed the bulb, watching the solution rush into the boy vein, sucked by silent thirst of blood.
"Jesus," said the boy. "I had never been hit like that before."
He lit a cigarette and looked around the kitchen, twitching in sugar need.
"Aren't you taking off?" he asked.
"With that milk sugar shit? Junk is a one-way street. No U-turn. You can't go back no more."
They call me the exterminator. At one brief point of intersection, I did exercise that function and witnessed the belly dance of roaches suffocating in yellow pyrethrum powder.
"Hard to get now, lady. War on. Let you have a little. $2.
Sluiced fat bedbugs from rose wallpaper in shabby theatrical hotels on North Clark and poisoned the purposeful rat, occasional eater of human babies. Wouldn't you? My present assignment? Find the live ones and exterminate. Not the bodies, but the molds, you understand. But I forget that you cannot understand. We have all but a very few. But even one could upset our food tray. The danger, as always, comes from defecting agents. AJ, the vigilante, the black armadillo, carrier of Chagas vectors, hasn't taken a bath since the Argentine epidemic of 35, remember? And Lee, and the sailor, and Benway. And I know some agent is out there in the darkness looking for me. Because all agents defect, and all resistors sell out. The Algebra of Need. Fats Terminal came from the city pressure tanks where open life jets spurt a million forms immediately eaten, the eaters canceled by black time fuzz. Few reach the plaza, a point where the tanks empty a tidal river, carrying forms of survival armed with defenses of poison slime, black flesh-rotting fungus, and green odors that sear the lungs and grab the stomach in twisted knots. Because Fats's nerves were raw and peeled to feel the death spasms of a million cold kicks, Fats learned the algebra of need and survived. One Friday, Fats siphoned himself into the plaza, a translucent gray fetal monkey, suckers on his little soft purple-gray hands, and a lamprey disc mouth of cold gray gristle lined with hollow black erectile teeth, feeling for the scar patterns of junk. And a rich man passed and stared at the monster, and Fats rolled, pissing and shitting in terror, and ate his shit, and the man was moved by this tribute to his potent gaze and clicked a coin out of his Friday cane. Friday is Muslim Sunday, when the rich are supposed to distribute alms. So Fats learned to serve the black meat and grew a fat aquarium of body, and his blank periscope eyes swept the world's surface. In his wake of addicts, translucent gray monkeys flashed like fish spears to the junk mark and hung there sucking, and it all drained back into Fats, so his substance grew and grew, filling plazas, restaurants, and waiting rooms of the world with gray junk ooze. Bulletins from party headquarters are spelled out in obscene charades by hebephrenics and latas and apes. Solubi's fart code. Negroes open and shut mouth to flash messages on gold teeth. Arab rioters send smoke signals by throwing great buttery eunuchs. They make the best smoke, hangs black and shit solid in the air. Onto gasoline fires in a rubbish heap, mosaic of melodies, sad panpipes of humpbacked beggar, cold wind sweeps down from postcard of Chimborazo, flutes of Ramadan, piano music down a windy street, mutilated police calls, advertising leaflets synchronized with street fight spell S.O.S. Two agents have identified themselves each to each by choice of sex practices. Foiling alien microphones, fuck atomic secrets back and forth in code so complex only two physicists in the world pretend to understand it, and each categorically denies the other. Later, the receiving agent will be hanged, convict of the guilty possession of a nervous system, and play back the message in orgasmal spasms transmitted from electrodes attached to the penis. Breathing rhythm of old cardiac, bumps of a belly dancer, put-put-put of a motorboat across oily water. The waiter lets fall a drop of martini on the man in the gray flannel suit, who lambs for the 612, knowing that he has been spotted. Junkies climb out of the lavatory window of the chop suey joint as the L rumbles past. The gimp, cowboyed in the Waldorf, gives birth to a litter of rats. Cowboy. New York hood talk means kill the motherfucker wherever you find him. A rat is a rat is a rat, is an informer. And even foolish virgins heed the English colonel who rides by brandishing a screaming peccary on his lance. The elegant fag patronizes his neighborhood pissoir to receive a bulletin from dead mother lives on in synapses and will evoke the exciting nanny beater. Boys jacking off in the school toilet know each other as agents from Galaxy X, adjourn to a second-run night spot where they sit shabby and portentous, drinking wine vinegar and sucking lemons to confound the tenor sax, a hip Arab in blue glasses, suspect to be enemy sender. Malarials of the world bundle in shivering protoplasm. Fear seals the turd message with a cuneiform account. Giggling rioters copulate to the screams of a burning nigra. Lonely librarians unite in soul kiss halitosis. That grippy feeling, brother? Sore throat, persistent and disquieting as the hot afternoon wind? Welcome to the International Syphilis Lodge.
Methodist Episcopal, goddammit.
Phrase used to test for speech impairment typical of paresis. Or the first touch of chancre makes you a member in good standing. The vibrating, soundless hum of deep forest and orgone accumulators, the sudden silence of cities when the junkie cops and even the commuter buzzes clogged lines of cholesterol for contact. Signal flares of orgasm burst over the world. A T-head leaps up, screaming, "I got the fear!" and runs into Mexican night, bringing down back brains of the world. The executioner shits in terror at sight of the condemned man. The torturer screams in the ear of his implacable victim. Knife fighters embrace in adrenaline. Cancer is at the door with a singing telegram.